See, if you weren't wasting your life reading this bullshit, you'd realize Batman ain't coming to save your ass or your people. I read the first question. Prior to declaring independence in 1957, the West African nation of Ghana was comprised of what two colonies? I didn't know the answer. I cocked my ears for the roar of the rocket-propelled Batmobile screeching around the corner, but could only hear my father's stopwatch ticking down the seconds. I gritted my teeth, placed my finger over the red button, and waited for the time limit to expire. The answer is Togoland and the Gold Coast. Obediently, as my father predicted, I pressed the button. The needles on the dial and my spine both straightened while I watched myself in the mirror jitterbug violently for a second or two.
Jesus, how many volts was that?
I asked, my hands shaking uncontrollably.
The subject will ask only the questions that are listed on the sheet, my dad said coldly,
reaching past me to turn a black dial a few clicks to the right so that the indicator now rested on triple X.
Now, please read the next question.
I began to suffer from a blurring of vision I suspected was psychosomatic, but nonetheless everything was as out of focus as a $5 bootleg video on a swap meet flat screen, and to read the next question, I had to hold the quivering paper to my nose. Of the 23,000 eighth-grade students who took the entrance exam for admission into Stuyvesant High, New York's most elite public high school, how many African Americans scored high enough to qualify for admission? When I finished reading, my nose began to bleed, red droplets of blood trickling from my left nostril and plopping onto the table in perfect one-second intervals. Eschewing his stopwatch, my father started the countdown. I glanced suspiciously at him. The question was too topical. Obviously, he'd been reading the New York Times at breakfast, prepping for the day's experiment by looking for racial fodder over a bowl of Rice Krispies. Flipping from page to page with a speed and rage that caused the paper's sharp corners to snap, crackle, and pop in the morning air. What would Batman do if he rushed into the kitchen right then and saw a father electrocuting his son for the good of science? Why, he'd open up his utility belt and bust out some of those tear gas pellets. And while my dad was choking on the fumes, he'd finish asphyxiating him, assuming there was enough bat rope to tie around his fat-ass hot dog neck. Then he'd burn out his eyeballs with the laser torch, use the miniature camera to take some pictures for bat posterity, then steal Pop's classic only-driven-on-trips-to-white neighborhood sky-blue Carmen Ghia convertible with the skeleton keys, and we'd bone the fuck out. That's what Batman would have done. But me, cowardly bat-fag that I was, and still am, I could only think to question the question's shoddy methodology. For instance, how many black students had taken the admissions test? What was the average class size at this Stuyvesant High? But this time, before the 10th drop of blood had landed on the table, and before my father could blurt out the answer, 7, I pressed the red button, self-administering a nerve-shattering, growth-stunting electric shock of a voltage that would have frightened Thor and lobotomized an already sedated, educated class, because now I, too, was curious. I wanted to see what happens when you bequeath a 10-year-old black boy to science. What I discovered was that the phrase evacuate one's bowels is a misnomer, because the opposite was true. My bowels evacuated me. It was a feces retreat comparable to the great evacuations of history. Dunkirk, Saigon, New Orleans. But unlike the Brits, the Vietnamese capitalists, and flooded out residents of the Ninth Ward, the occupants of my intestinal tract had nowhere to go. What runny parts of that fetid tidal wave of shit and urine that didn't encamp itself about my buttocks and balls ran down my legs and pooled in and around my sneakers. Not wanting to hinder the integrity of his experiment, my father simply pinched his nose shut and motioned for me to proceed. Thank goodness I knew the answer to the third question.
How many chambers are in the Wu-Tang?
Because if I hadn't, my brain would be the ash-gray color and consistency of a barbecue briquette on the 5th of July. My crash course in childhood development ended 2 years later, when Dad tried to replicate Doctors Kenneth and Mamie Clark's study of color consciousness in black children using white and black dolls. My father's version, of course, was a little more revolutionary, a tad more modern. While the Clarks sat two cherubic, life-size, saddle-shoe-shod dolls, one white and one colored, in front of school children, and asked them to choose the one they preferred, my father placed two elaborate doll scapes in front of me and asked me,
"With whom, with what social cultural subtext are you down with, son?"
Dollscape 1 featured Ken and Malibu Barbie dressed in matching bathing suits, appropriately snorkeled and goggled, cooling by the Dreamhouse pool. In Dollscape 2, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Harriet Tubman, and a brown-skinned, egg-shaped weeble toy were running and wobbling through a swampy thicket from a pack of plastic German shepherds, leading an armed lynch party comprised of my G.I. Joes hooded in Ku Klux Klan sheets.
"What's that?"
I asked, pointing to a small white Christmas ornament that spun slowly over the bog, glittering and sparkling like a disco ball in the afternoon sun.
"That's the North Star. They're running toward the North Star, toward freedom."
I picked up Martin, Malcolm, and Harriet, teasing my dad by asking,
"What are these in-action figures?"
Martin Luther King Jr. looked okay, stylishly dressed in a glossy, black, tight-fitting suit, a copy of Gandhi's autobiography glued to one hand and a microphone in the other. Malcolm was similarly outfitted, but was bespectacled and holding a burning Molotov cocktail that was slowly melting his hand. The smiling, racially ambiguous Weeble, which looked suspiciously like a boyhood version of my father, stayed true to its advertising slogan by wobbling and never falling down, whether balanced precariously in the palm of my hand or chased by the knights of white supremacy. There was something wrong with Miss Tubman, though. She was outfitted in a form-fitting burlap sack, and I don't remember any of my history primers describing the woman known as Moses as being statuesque with a 36-24-36 hourglass figure, long silky hair, plucked eyebrows, blue eyes, dick-sucking lips, and pointy titties.
"Dad, you painted Barbie black?"
"I wanted to maintain the beauty threshold. Establish a baseline of cuteness so that you couldn't say one doll was prettier than the other."
Plantation Barbie had a string coming out of her back. I pulled it.
"Math is hard. Let's go shopping,"
she said in a squeaky, sing-song voice. I set the black heroes back down in the kitchen table swamp, moving their limbs so that they resumed their runaway poses.
"I'm down with Ken and Barbie."
My father lost his scientific objectivity and grabbed me by the shirt.
"What? Why?" he yelled.
"Because the white people got better accessories. I mean, look, Harriet Tubman has a gas lantern, a walking stick, and a compass. Ken and Barbie have a dune buggy and speedboat. It's really no contest."
The next day, my father burned his findings in the fireplace. Even at the junior college level, it's publish or perish. But more than the fact he'd never get a parking space with his name on it or a reduced course load, I was a failed social experiment. A statistically insignificant son who'd shattered his hopes for both me and the black race. He made me turn in my dream book, stop calling my allowance positive reinforcement, and began referring to it as restitution. While he never stopped pushing the book learning, it wasn't long after this that he bought my first spade, pitchfork, and sheep-shearing razor, sending me into the fields with a pat on the tush and Booker T. Washington's famous quote pinned to my denim overalls for encouragement, "Cast down your bucket where you are." If there is a heaven worth the effort that people make to get there, then I hope for my father's sake there's a celestial psychology journal. One that publishes the results of failed experiments, because acknowledging unsubstantiated theories and negative results is just as important as publishing studies proving red wine is the cure-all we'd always pretended it was. My memories of my father aren't all bad. Though technically I was an only child, Daddy, like many black men, had lots of kids. The citizens of Dickens were his progeny. While he wasn't very good with horses, he was known around town as the Nigger Whisperer. Whenever some nigger who done lost they motherfucking mind needed to be talked down from a tree or freeway overpass precipice, the call would go out. My father would grab his social psychology Bible, The Planning of Change by Benes, Benet, and Robert Chin, a woefully underappreciated Chinese-American psychologist my dad had never met but claimed as his mentor. Most kids got bedtime stories and fairy tales. I had to fall asleep to readings from chapters with titles like The Utility of Models of the Environments of Systems for Practitioners. My father was nothing if not a practitioner. I can't remember a time when he didn't bring me along on a nigger whisper. On the drive over, he'd brag that the black community was a lot like him. ABD.
All but dissertation?
All but defeated.
When we arrived, he'd sit me on the roof of a nearby minivan or stand me atop an alleyway dumpster, hand me a legal pad, and tell me to take notes. Among all the flashing sirens, the crying and broken glass crunching softly under his buckskin shoes, I'd be so scared for him. But Daddy had a way of approaching the unapproachable, his face sympathetic and sullen, palms turned up like a dashboard Jesus figurine. He'd walk toward some knife-wielding lunatic whose pupils were dilated to the size of atoms smashed by a quart of Hennessy XO and a 12-pack light beer chaser. Ignoring the blood-stained work uniform caked in brain and fecal matter, he'd hug the person like he was greeting an old friend. People thought it was his selflessness that allowed him to get so close, but to me, it was his voice that got him over. Doo-wop bass deep, my father spoke in F-sharp, a resonant, low-pitched tone that rooted you in place like a bobby-socked teenager listening to the Five Satins sing in the still of the night. It's not music that soothes the savage beast, but the systematic desensitization. And father's voice had a way of relaxing the enraged and allowing them to confront their fears anxiety-free. When I was in grade school, I knew from how the taste of the pomegranates would bring you to tears, from the way the summer sun turned our afros blood orange red, and from how giddy my father would get whenever he talked about Dodger Stadium, White Zinfandel, and the latest green flash sunset he'd seen from the summit of Mount Wilson, that California was a special place. And if you think about it, pretty much everything that made the 20th century bearable was invented in a California garage. The Apple computer, the boogie board, and gangster rap. Thanks to my dad's career in nigger whispering, I was there for the birth of the latter, when at 6 o'clock on a cold, dark ghetto morning, 2 blocks down from where I live, Carl Kilo G. Garfield, hallucinating high on his own supply and Alfred Lloyd Tennyson's brooding lyricism, burst out of his garage squinting into his moleskin, a smoldering crack pipe dangling from fingertips. It was the height of the crack rock era. I was about 10 when he clambered into the bed of his tricked-out, hot-rod, yellow Toyota pickup truck, the T.O. and the T.A. buffed out and painted over so that the brand name on the tailgate read just Yo, and began reciting his verse at the top of his lungs, the slurred iambic pentameter punctuated with gun claps from his nickel-plated .38, and pleas from his mama to take his naked ass inside. The charge of the light-skinned spade. Half a liter, half a liter, half a liter onward. All in the alley of death rode the old English 800. Forward, the light-skinned spade. Charge for the bloods, he said. Into the alley of death rode the old English 800. When the SWAT team finally arrived on the scene, taking cover behind patrol car doors and the sycamore trees, clutching their assault rifles to their chests. None of them could stop giggling long enough to take the kill shot.
There's not to reason what the fuck. There's but to shoot and duck. Niggers to the right of them. Niggers to the left of them. Niggers in front of them. Partied and blundered. Bum rushed at caps and hollow point shell, while hoopty and hoodlum fell. They that had banged so well came through the jaws of death back from the holes of hell. All that was left of them, left of the old English 800.
And when my father, the nigger whisperer, that beatific smile splashed across his face, eased his way past the police barricade, put a tweed-jacketed arm around the broken-down drug dealer, and spoke some whispered profundity into his ear, Kilo G blinked blankly, like a stage show volunteer struck dumb by an Indian casino hypnotist, then calmly handed over his gun and the keys to his heart. The police closed in for the arrest, but my father asked them to stay back, beckoning Kilo to finish his poem, even joining in at the end of each line, pretending he knew the words.
When can there shine and buzz fate? Oh, the buck wild charge they made. All the motherfucking world wondered. Respect the charge they made. Respect the charge of the light-skinned spade. The noble, now empty, old English 800.
The police vans and cruisers disappeared into the morning haze, leaving my father godlike, alone in the middle of the street, reveling in his humanitarianism. Cockily, he turned toward me.
You know what I said to get that psychotic motherfucker to lower his gun?
What did you say, Daddy?
I said, brother, you have to ask yourself two questions. Who am I? And how may I become myself? That's basic person-centered therapeutics. You want the client to feel important, to feel that he or she is in control of the healing process. Remember that shit.
I wanted to ask him why he never spoke to me in the same reassuring tone that he used with his clients. But I knew instead of an answer, I'd get the belt, and my healing process would involve mercurochrome, and in place of being grounded, a sentence of 5 to no less than 3 weeks of Jungian active imagination. In the distance, hurtling away from me like some distant spiral galaxy, the red and blue sirens spun silently but brilliantly, lighting up the mist of the morning marine layer like some inner city aurora borealis. I fingered a bullet hole in the tree bark, thinking that like the slug buried 10 rings deep in the trunk, I'd never leave this neighborhood. That I'd go to the local high school, graduate in the middle of my class, another Willy Lump-Lump with a 6-line resume rife with spelling errors, trekking back and forth between the job center, the strip club parking lot, and the civil service exam tutorials. I'd marry, fuck, and kill Marpessa Delissa Dawson, the bitch next door, and my one and only love. Have kids, threaten them with military school and promises not to bail them out if they ever got arrested. I'd be the type of nigger who played pool at the titty bar and cheated on his wife with the blonde cheese girl from the Trader Joe's on National and Westwood Boulevards. I'd stop pestering my father about my missing mother, finally admitting to myself that motherhood, like the artistic trilogy, is overrated. After a lifetime of beating myself up for never having been breastfed or finishing The Lord of the Rings, Paradise, and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, eventually, like all lower middle class Californians, I'd die in the same bedroom I'd grown up in, looking up at the cracks in the stucco ceiling that have been there since the 68 quake. So introspective questions like, who am I and how can I be that person, didn't pertain to me then, because I already knew the answer. Like the entire town of Dickens, I was my father's child, a product of my environment and nothing more. Dickens was me, and I was my father. Problem is, they both disappeared from my life. First my dad, and then my hometown, and suddenly I had no idea who I was, and no clue how to become myself. Chapter 2
West Side, nigga, what?
Chapter 3 The three basic laws of ghetto physics are niggas in your face tend to stay in your face. No matter where the sun is in the sky, the time is always half past a monkey's ass and a quarter to his balls. And the third is that whenever someone you love has been shot, invariably you will be back home on winter break halfway through your junior year of college, taking the horse on a little afternoon ride to rendezvous with your father for a meeting of the Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals, the local think tank, where he and the rest of the neighborhood savants will ply you with cider, cinnamon rolls, and conversion therapy. Not that your dad thinks that you're gay, but he's worried that you never stay out past 11 and the word booty doesn't seem to be in your vocabulary. It's a cold night. You're minding your own business, savoring the last of your vanilla shake, when you come upon a drove of detectives huddled around the body. You dismount, step closer, and recognize a shoe or a shirt sleeve or a piece of jewelry. My father was face down in the intersection. I recognized him by his fist, cocked and knuckled up tight, the veins on the back of his hands still bulging and full. I compromised the crime scene by picking lint off his matted afro, straightening the rumpled collar of his Oxford shirt, brushing the pebbles of gravel from his cheek, and according to the police report, most egregiously by sticking my hand in the blood pooled around his body, which, to my surprise, was cold. Not hot, roiling with the black anger and lifelong frustration of a decent, albeit slightly crazy, man who never became what he thought he was.
You the son?
The detective looked me up and down, his brow wrinkled, his eyes flicking back and forth from identifying feature to identifying feature. Behind the dismissive smirk, I could almost see his brain cross-referencing my scars, height, and build with some database of wanted felons filed inside his head.
Yes, I am. You, something special.
Huh?
The officers involved said that when he charged them, he shouted, and I quote, I'm warning you. You anal retentive, authoritarian archetypes. You don't know who my son is. So you someone special?
Who am I, and how can I be that person?
No, I'm no one special.
You're supposed to cry when your dad dies. Curse the system because your father has died at the hands of the police. Bemoan being lower middle class and colored in a police state that protects only rich white people and movie stars of all races, though I can't think of any Asian American ones. But I didn't cry. I thought his death was a trick. Another one of his elaborate schemes to educate me on the plight of the black race and to inspire me to make something of myself. I half expected him to get up, brush himself off, and say,
See, nigger, if this could happen to the world's smartest black man, just imagine what could happen to your dumb ass. Just because racism is dead don't mean they still don't shoot niggers on sight.
Now, if I had my druthers, I couldn't care less about being black. To this day, when the census form arrives in the mail under the race question, I check the box marked some other race and proudly write in Californian. Of course, 2 months later, a census worker shows up at my door, takes one look at me, and says,
You foul, nigger. As a black man, what do you have to say for yourself?
And as a black man, I never have anything to say for myself. Hence the need for a motto, which, if we had, I'd raise my fist, shout it out, and slam the door in the government's face. But we don't. So I mumble sorry and scribble my initials next to the box marked Black African American Negro Coward. No. What little inspiration I have in life comes not from any sense of racial pride. It stems from the same age-old yearning that has produced great presidents and great pretenders, both captains of industry and captains of football. That edible yen that makes men do all sorts of shit we'd rather not do. Like try out for basketball and fistfight the kid next door because in this family, we don't start shit, but we damn sure finish it. I speak only of that most basic of needs, the child's needs to please the father. Many fathers foster that need in their children through a wanton manipulation that starts in infancy. They dote on the kids with airplane spins, ice cream cones on cold days, and weekend custody trips to the Salton Sea and the Science Museum. The incessant magic tricks that produced dollar pieces out of thin air and the open house mind games that made you think that the view from the second floor Tudor-style miracle in the hills, if not the world, would soon be yours are designed to fool us into believing that without daddies and the fatherly guidance they provide, the rest of our lives will be futile, Mickey Mouse-less, I-told-you-so existences. But later in adolescence, after one too many accidental driveway basketball elbows, drunken midnight slaps to the upside of our heads, puffs of crystal meth exhaled in our faces, jalapeno pepper snapped in half and ground into our lips for saying fuck when you were only trying to be like daddy, you come to realize that the frozen niceties and trips to the drive-through car wash were bait-and-switch parenting. Ploys and cover-ups for their reduced sex drives, stagnant take-home pay, and their own inabilities to live up to their father's expectations. The edible yen to please father is so powerful that it holds sway even in a neighborhood like mine, where fatherhood, for the most part, happens in absentia. Yet nevertheless, the kids sit dutifully by the window at night, waiting for daddy to come home. Of course, my problem was that daddy was always home. After all the evidence photos had been taken, the witnesses interviewed and macabre homicide jokes cracked, without dropping my shake, I lifted my father's bullet-riddled body up by the underarms and dragged his heels through the chalk outline, through the yellow-numbered shell-casing markers, through the intersection, the parking lot, and the glass double doors. I sat my father down at his favorite table, ordered his usual, 2 chocolate frosteds and a large milk, and placed it in front of him. Since he had arrived 35 minutes late and dead, the meeting was already in progress, chaired by Foy Cheshire, fading TV personality, erstwhile friend of my father, and a man all too anxious to fill the void in leadership. There was a brief moment of awkwardness, the skeptical dum-dums looking at the heavyset Foy like the nation must have looked to Andrew Johnson after Lincoln had been assassinated. I loudly slurped up the dregs of my shake, the signal to carry on, because that's the way my father would have wanted it. The dum-dum donut revolution must go on. My father founded the dum-dum donut intellectuals way back when he noticed that the local dum-dum donuts franchise was the only non-Latino or black-owned business that wasn't burned and pillaged in the riots. In fact, looters, police officers, and firemen alike used the 24-hour drive-through window to fuel up on crullers, cinnamon twists, and the surprisingly good lemonade as they fought off the conflagration, the fatigue, and the pesky news crews who asked anyone within arm's length of a microphone, "Do you think the riots will change anything?" "Well, I'm on TV, ain't I, bitch?" In all its years of existence, Dum Dum Donuts has never been robbed, burglarized, egged, or vandalized. And to this day, the franchise's Art Deco facade remains graffiti and piss-stain free. Customers don't park in the handicapped spot. Bicyclists leave their vehicles unlocked and unattended, stuffed neatly into the rack like Dutch cruisers parked at an Amsterdam train station. There's something tranquil, almost monastic, about the inner-city donut shop. It's clean, spotless. The employees are always sane and respectful. Maybe it's the muted lighting or the bright decor, whose color scheme is designed to be emblematic of a maple frosted with rainbow sprinkles. Whatever it is, my father recognized the donut shop was the one place in Dickens where niggers knew how to act. People passed the non-dairy creamer. Strangers politely pointed to the tip of your nose and made the universal sign for brush the powdered sugar off your face. In 7.81 square miles of vaunted black community, the 850 square feet of Dum Dum Donuts was the only place in the community where one could experience the Latin root of the word, where a citizen could revel in common togetherness. So one rainy Sunday afternoon, not long after the tanks and media attention had left, my father ordered his usual. He sat at the table nearest the ATM and said aloud to no one in particular, "Do you know that the average household net worth for whites is $113,149 per year? Hispanics is $6,325, and black folks, $5,677. For real? What's your source material, nigga? The Pew Research Center. Motherfuckers from Harvard to Harlem respect the Pew Research Center. And hearing this, the concerned patrons turned around in their squeaky plastic seats as best they could, given that donut shop swivel chairs swivel only 6 degrees in either direction. Pops politely asked the manager to dim the lights. I switched on the overhead projector, slid a transparency over the glass, and together we craned our necks toward the ceiling, where a bar graph titled Income Disparity as Determined by Race hovered overhead, like some dark, damning, statistical cumulonimbus cloud threatening to rain on our collective parades. I was wondering what that little nigger was doing in a donut shop with a damn overhead projector. Next thing the people knew, my father, interspersed with a macroeconomic circulation flowchart there, a sketch of Milton Friedman here, was facilitating an impromptu seminar about the evils of deregulation and institutional racism. How it wasn't the Keynesian lapdog so beloved by the banks and the media who predicted the most recent financial meltdown, but the behavioral economists who knew that the market isn't swayed by interest rates and fluctuations in GDP, rather by greed, fear, and fiscal illusion. The discussion grew animated. Their mouths stuffed with pastries, their lips flaked with coconut shavings, the Dum Dum Donuts patrons decreed low-interest checking and the nerve of the goddamn cable company to charge late fees for not promptly paying ahead of time in July for services not rendered until August. One woman, her jowls filled to near bursting with macaroons, asked my father, "How much the chinos make?" "Well, Asian men earn more than any other demographic."
"Even the faggots?"
shouted the assistant manager.
"You sure Asians make more than the faggots? 'Cause I hear faggots be making cash hand over fist."
"Yes, even the homosexuals. But remember, Asian men have no power." "And what about the gay Asian males? Have you done a regression analysis controlling for race and sexual orientation?" That insightful comment came from Ford Cheshire, about 10 years older than my dad, standing next to the water fountain, hands in his pockets, and wearing a wool sweater, even though it was 75 degrees outside. This was way before the money and fame. Back then, he was an assistant professor in urban studies at UC Brentwood, living in Larchmont with the rest of the L.A. intellectual class, and hanging out in Dickens doing field research for his first book, Blacktopolis, The Intransigence of African-American Urban Poverty and Baggy Clothes. I think an examination of the confluence of independent variables on income could result in some interesting R coefficients. Frankly, I wouldn't be surprised by p-values in the 0.75 range. Despite the smug attitude, Pops took a liking to Foy right away. Though Foy was born and raised in Michigan, it wasn't often Dad found somebody in Dickens who knew the difference between a t-test and an analysis of variance. After debriefing over a box of donut holes, everyone, locals and Foy included, agreed to meet on a regular basis, and the Dum Dum Donut intellectuals were born. But where my father saw an opportunity for information exchange, public advocacy, and communal counsel, Foy saw a midlife springboard to fame. Things between the two of them started amicably enough. They strategized and chased women together. But after a few years, Foy Cheshire got famous, and my father never did. Foy was no deep thinker. But back then, He was infinitely better organized than my dad, whose main strength was also his biggest weakness. He was way ahead of his time. While my dad was writing incomprehensible and unpublishable theories linking black oppression, game, and social learning theory, Foy hosted a television talk show, interviewing B-list celebrities and political figures, writing magazine articles, and taking meetings in Hollywood. Once, while watching my father typing away at his desk, I asked him where his ideas came from. He turned around, his tongue thick with Scotch whiskey, and said, "The real question is not where do ideas come from, but where do they go?"
"So, where do they go?"
"Punk motherfuckers like Foy Cheshire steal them and make not-so-small fortunes off your shit and invite you to the launch party like nothing happened."
The idea that Foy stole from my father was an award-winning Saturday morning cartoon called The Black Cats and Jammin' Kids, a show that had been syndicated around the world, dubbed into 7 languages, and in the late mid-90s made Foy enough money to buy a dream house in the hills. My father never said anything in public, never confronted Foy at the meetings because, as he put it, "Our people are in dire need of everything except acrimony." And in later years, when L.A. had turned Foy out like the small-town runaway he was at heart, after he'd lost his bankroll to a drug habit and a series of freckle-faced Creole L.A. women, been cheated out of his residuals by the production company, and had everything but his house and car seized by the IRS for tax evasion, my father kept quiet. When, gun to temple, Foy, flat broke and embarrassed, called to ask my dad to nigger whisper him out of his suicidal funk, my father maintained patient-doctor confidentiality, kept silent about the night sweats, the voices, the narcissistic personality disorder diagnosis, and the 3-week psychiatric hospitalization. And the night my devoutly atheist father died, Foy prayed and spoke over him, hugged his lifeless body to his chest, and then acted as if the blood on his sparkling white Hugo Boss shirt was his own. You could see in his face that, despite his speech and poignant words about my father's death symbolizing black injustice, deep down, he was happy my dad was gone. Because with my dad's death, his secrets were safe. And maybe his grandiose Robespierre pipe dreams about the dum-dum donut intellectuals being the black equivalent to the Jacobins might come true. As the dum-dums debated how to mete out a measure of revenge, I adjourned the meeting early by dragging my dad's body past the drink cooler and placing his corpse on the rear end of my horse, face down on the rump, like in the cowboy movies, his arms and legs dangling in the air. At first, the members tried to stop me, because how dare I remove the martyr before they had an opportunity for a photo op. Then the police took their turn, blocking the streets with their cars so that I couldn't pass. I cried and cursed, circled my mount in the intersection, and threatened anyone who came near me with a horseshoe kick to the forehead. Eventually, the call went out for the nigger whisperer, but the nigger whisperer was dead. The crisis negotiator, Police Captain Murray Flores, was a man my dad had worked with on many a nigger whispering. He knew his job well enough not to soft soap the situation. And after raising my father's head up to look him in the face, he spat on the ground in disgust and said, "What can I say? You can tell me how it happened. It was accidental." "And accidental means..." "Off the record, it means your dad pulled up behind plainclothes officers Orozco and Medina, who were stopped at a traffic light, talking to a homeless woman. After the light changed from green to red a couple of times, your dad zipped around them and, while making a louis, yelled something, whereupon Officer Orozco issued a traffic ticket and a stern warning. Your father said, 'Either give me the ticket or the lecture. You can't give me both.' He stole that from Bill Russell." "Exactly. You know your father. The officers took exception, pulled their guns. Your dad ran like any sensible person would. They fired 4 shots into his back and left him for dead in the intersection. So now you know. You just have to allow me to do my job. You have to let the system hold the men responsible for this accountable. So just give me the body. I asked Captain Flores a question my father had asked me many times. In the history of the Los Angeles Police Department, do you know how many officers have been convicted of murder while in the line of duty? No. The answer is none. So there is no accountability. I'm taking him. Where? I'm going to bury him in the backyard. You do what you have to do. I don't think I'd ever seen a cop blow a whistle before. Not in real life. But Captain Flores blew his brass-plated whistle and waved the other officers, Foy and the dum-dum donut protesters, off. The blockade parted, and I led a very slow-moving funeral procession to 205 Bernard Avenue. It had always been my father's dream to own 205 Bernard Avenue outright. The Ponderosa, he called it. Sharecropping, transracial adoption, and renting to own is for suckers. He liked to say, while he pored through real estate and no-money-down investment books, punching imaginary mortgage scenarios into the calculator. My memoir, that'll be an easy 20,000 up front. We can pawn your mama's jewelry for 5-6 thou. And even though there's an early withdrawal penalty on your college fund, if we cash that mug out now, home ownership will be right around the corner. There never was any memoir. Only titles shouted out while he was in the shower fucking some 19-year-old bubblegum-blowing colleague from the university. He'd stick his wet head out the door and, through the steam, ask what did I think about the interpretation of Nickers, or my favorite, I'm I, you're I, and there was no jewelry. My mother, a former Jet magazine beauty of the week, had no baubles or trinkets on in the faded tear sheet pasted above my headboard. She was a modestly coiffed, curvy expanse of thighs and lip gloss lounging on a backyard diving board in a gold lamé bikini. All I knew about her was the extensive biographical information listed in the bottom right-hand corner of the photo. Laurel Lescook is a student from Key Biscayne, Florida, who enjoys biking, photography, and poetry. Later in life, I would track Miss Lescook down. She was a paralegal in Atlanta who remembered my father as a man whom she'd never met, but who, after her one photo pictorial came out in September of 77, inundated her with marriage proposals, creepy poetry, and Kodak Instamatic photos of his erect penis. Given that my college savings amounted to $236.72, the total take from my sparsely attended black mitzvah, and that both my father's manuscript and my mother's jewelry collection were non-existent, you'd think we'd never come to own that house. But as luck would have it, given my father's wrongful death at the hands of the police and the $2 million settlement I'd later received, in a sense, he and I bought the farm on the same day. At first blush, his purchase of the proverbial farm seems the more metaphorical of the two transactions. But as even the most cursory of those early annual inspections by the California Department of Food and Agriculture bore out, to call 205 Bernard Avenue, that two-acre, just this side of lunar surface, fertile parcel of land in the most infamous ghetto in Los Angeles County, with its hollowed-out 1973 Winnebago Chieftain motorhome for a barn, a dilapidated, overcrowded Section 8 henhouse topped by a weather vane so rusted in place that the Santa Ana winds, El Nino, and the 83 tornado couldn't move it. Medfly-infested two-tree lemon grove, 3 horses, 4 pigs, a 2-legged goat with shopping cart wheels for back hooves, 12 stray cats, One cowherd of livestock and the ever-present cumulonimbus cloud of flies that circled the inflatable fishing pond of liquefied swamp gas and fermented rat shit that I pulled out of foreclosure on the very same day my dad decided to tell the undercover police officer, Edward Orozco, to move his piece of shit Ford Crown Victoria and stop blocking the goddamn intersection. With funds borrowed against what the courts would later determine to be a $2 million settlement for gross miscarriage of justice. To call that unsubsidized tract of inner-city Afro-agrarian ineptitude a farm would be to push the limits of literality. Had me and Pops founded Jamestown instead of the Pilgrims, the Indians would have looked at our wilted, meandering, labyrinth-like rows of maize and kumquats and said, "Today's corn-planting seminar is canceled, because you niggas ain't gonna make it." When you grow up on a farm in the middle of the ghetto, you come to see that what your father always told you during morning chores was true. People eat the shit you shovel them. That, like the pigs, we all have our heads in the trough. While the hogs don't believe in God, the American dream, or the pen being mightier than the sword, they do believe in the feed in the same desperate way we believe in the Sunday paper, the Bible, black urban radio, and hot sauce. On his off days, he'd often invite the neighborhood over just to watch me work. Though the farms was zoned for agriculture, most of the families had long abandoned the salt-of-the-earth farming lifestyle for backyard acreage that featured full-sized basketball and tennis courts, and maybe a guest cottage in the corner. And although a few families still maintained chicken coops and maybe raised a cow or ran an equestrian school for at-risk youth, we were the only family giving full-scale farming a go, trying to cash in on some forgotten post-Civil War promise. 40 acres and a fool. "This little nigger not gonna be like the rest of you niggers," my father would crow, one hand on his dick, the other pointing at me. "My son gonna be a Renaissance nigger, a modern-day Galileo out this motherfucker." Then he'd crack open a bottle of Bumpy Face, hand out the paper cups, ice cubes, and splashes of lemon-lime soda, and from the back porch they'd watch me pick strawberries, snow peas, or whatever the fuck was in season. Cotton was the worst. Forget the stooping, the thorns, the droning Paul Robeson spirituals that he played loud enough to drown out the Lopez's ranchero music coming from next door, or that planting, watering, and harvesting cotton was a complete waste of time because the only gin we had was the styrofoam cup of Seagram's in his hand. Picking cotton sucked because it made Daddy nostalgic. A sentimental drunk and full of gin and juice pride, he'd brag to our black neighbors how I'd never spent a day in daycare or had a sandbox playdate. Instead, he swore up and down I was nannied and mammied by a sow named Susie Q, and was the loser in a sibling piglet versus niglet rivalry to a porcine genius named Savoir Faire. Daddy's friends would watch me expertly pluck cotton balls from the dried stems, waiting for me to snort and overthrow the Orwellian social order, and thus confirm my hog-tied upbringing. 1, whatever goes upon 2 legs is an enemy. 2, whatever goes on 4 legs or 6 wings and a biscuit is a friend. 3, no pigger shall wear shorts in the fall, much less the winter. 4, no pigger shall be caught sleeping. 5, no pigger shall drink pre-sweetened Kool-Aid. 6, all piggers are created equal, but some piggers ain't shit. I don't remember my father tying my right hand behind my back or being babysat in the pig pen, but I do remember pushing Savoir Faire, one hand on each prickly, milk-fattened hindquarter, up the wooden ramp and into the trailer. The last driver on earth to use hand signals, my father took the corners slowly, lecturing me on how fall was the best time to kill a pig because there were less flies, and the meat would keep for a while outside, because once you freeze it, the quality starts to go down. Unbuckled, like any child raised before a car seat and airbags, I knelt in the seat facing backward, looking out that tiny rear window at Savoy Fair, the doomed, cloven-hoofed genius squealing like a 400-pound bitch the whole way to the slaughterhouse.
You done won your last game of Connect Four, you fucking getting mucus on the pieces. I sunk your battleship. King me, son of a bitch.
At stoplights, Daddy would stick his arm out of the window, bent at the elbow, hand toward the ground, palm facing the rear.
People eat the shit you shovel 'em, he'd shout over the radio music.
Somehow shifting, steering, turning on the blinker, making the hand signal a left turn, singing along to Ella Fitzgerald and reading the L.A. Times bestseller list all at the same time. People eat the shit you shovel them. I'd like to say I buried my father in the backyard and that day I became a man, or some other droll American bullshit, but all that happened was that day I became relieved. No more trying to look uninvolved as my own father fought for parking spaces at the farmer's market, shouting down Beverly Hills dowagers, asserting their luxury sedan right of way by nosing their gigantic cars into spaces marked compact only.
You stupid, over-medicated bitch. If you don't back that fucking jalopy out my space, I swear to God I'm gonna punch you in your anti-aging cold cream face and permanently reverse 500 years of white privilege and $500,000 of plastic surgery.
People eat the shit you shovel them. And sometimes, when I pull up to the drive-through window on horseback or return the disbelieving stares of a convertible carload of out-of-town vatos pointing at the black vaquero grazing his livestock in the trash-strewn fields underneath the power lines that stretch Eiffel Tower-like alongside West Greenleaf Boulevard, I think about all the lines of ad infinitum bullshit my father shoveled down my throat until his dreams became my dreams. Sometimes, while I'm sharpening the plowshare and shearing the sheep, I feel like every moment of my life isn't mine, but one of his deja vus. No, I don't miss my father. I just regret that I never had the nerve to ask him if it was really true that I'd spent the sensory motor and pre-operational stages of my life with one hand tied behind my back. Talk about starting life off with a handicap. Fuck being black. Try learning to crawl, ride a tricycle, cover both eyes while playing peekaboo, and constructing a meaningful theory of mind, all with one hand.
Chapter 4.
You won't find Dickens, California on the map, because about 5 years after my father died, and a year after I graduated college, it too perished. There was no loud send-off. Dickens didn't go out with a bang like Nagasaki, Sodom and Gomorrah, and my dad. It was quietly removed, like those towns that vanished from maps of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, atomic accident by atomic accident. But the city of Dickens's disappearance was no accident. It was part of a blatant conspiracy by the surrounding, increasingly affluent two-car garage communities to keep their property values up and blood pressures down. When the housing boom hit in the early part of the century, many moderate-income neighborhoods in Los Angeles County underwent real estate makeovers. Once pleasant working-class enclaves became rife with fake tits and fake graduation and crime rates, hair and tree transplants, lipo and cholo suctions. In the wee hours of the night, after the community boards, homeowner associations, and real estate moguls banded together and coined descriptive names for nondescript neighborhoods, someone would bolt a large, glittery Mediterranean blue sign high up on a telephone pole. And when the fog lifted, the residents of the soon-to-be-gentrified blocks awoke to find out they lived in Crestview, La Cienega Heights, or Westdale. Even though there weren't any topographical features like crests, views, heights, or dales to be found within 10 miles. Nowadays, Angelenos, who used to see themselves as denizens of the west, east, and south sides, wage protracted legal battles over whether their two-bedroom, charming country cottages reside within the confines of Beverly Wood or Beverly Wood adjacent. Dickens underwent a different type of transition. One clear south central morning, we awoke to find that the city hadn't been renamed, but the signs that said, "Welcome to the City of Dickens," were gone. There was never an official announcement, an article in the paper, or a feature on the evening news. No one cared. In a way, most Dickensians were relieved to not be from anywhere. It saved them the embarrassment of having to answer the small talk, "Where are you from?" question with Dickens, then watching the person apologetically back away from you. "Sorry about that. Don't kill me." Rumor had it, the county had revoked our charter because of the admittedly widespread local political corruption. The police and fire stations were closed down. You'd call what used to be City Hall, and a foul-mouthed teenager named Rebecca would answer. "Don't no niggas named Dickens live here, so don't be calling here no more." The autonomous school board dismantled. Internet searches turned up only references to Dickens. Charles John Huffam, and to a Dust Bowl county in Texas, named after some unfortunate sap who may or may not have died at the Alamo. In the years after my father died, the neighborhood looked to me to be the next nigger whisperer. I wish I could say that I answered the call to duty out of a sense of familial pride and communal concern, but the truth was, I did it because I had no social life. Nigger whispering got me out of the house and away from the crops and the animals. I met interesting people and tried to convince them that no matter how much heroin and R. Kelly they had in their systems, they absolutely could not fly. When my father nigger whispered, it didn't look so hard. Unfortunately, I wasn't blessed with my father's sonorous, luxury car commercial voiceover bass profundo. I'm squeamishly shrill and possess all the speaking gravitas of the shyest member of your favorite boy band. The skinny, soft-spoken one, who in the music video sits in the back seat of the convertible and never gets the girl, much less a solo. So, I was issued a bullhorn. Ever try to whisper through a bullhorn? Up until the city's disappearance, the workload wasn't so bad. I was an every-other-month crisis negotiator, a farmer doing a little nigger whispering on the side. But since Dickens is erasure, I found myself in my pajamas at least once a week, standing barefoot in an apartment complex courtyard, bullhorn in hand, staring up at some distraught, partially hot-combed-headed mother dangling her baby over a second-floor balcony ledge. When my father did the whispering, Friday nights were the busiest. Every payday he'd be inundated by teeming hordes of the bipolar poor, who, having spent it all in one place and grown tired and unsated from the night's notoriously shitty primetime television lineup, would unwedge themselves from between the couch-bound obese family members and the boxes of unsold Avon beauty products, turn off the kitchen radio, pumping song after song, extolling the virtues of Friday nights, living it up at the club, popping bottles, niggers, and cherries in that order, then having canceled the next day's appointment with their mental health care professional, the chatterbox cosmetologist who, after years doing heads, still knows only one hairstyle, fried, dyed, and laid to the side. They'd choose that Friday, day of Venus, goddess of love, beauty, and unpaid bills, to commit suicide, murder, or both. But under my watch, people tend to snap on Wednesday, hump day. And so sans juju, gree-gree, and the foggiest notion of what to say, I'll press the trigger, and with a loud squeal of ear-piercing feedback, the bullhorn buzzes to staticky life. Half the unchosen tribe waiting for me to say the magic words and save the day, the other half waiting expectantly for a bathrobe to fly open and some milk-engorged titties to come popping out. Sometimes I open with a little humor, remove a slip of paper from a large manila envelope, and in my best impersonation of a sensationalist afternoon talk show host, announced, "When it comes to 8-month-old Kobe Jordan Kareem LeBron Mayweather III, I am not the father, but I wish I were. And providing I don't look too much like the baby's